There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Let's face it, people do not need another piece of our mind, but they do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So I think you are just the person to give it to them. I invite you to grab some resources. We've got some posted for you online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can always like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter at Carmen LaBerge. All right, speaking of Twitter, I've been on Twitter all day, as I've, with many people across the country, been watching. I know you're thinking to yourself, who's sitting around watching the Supreme Court process unfolding in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee? Well, people in my circle of friends are apparently watching it, because my Twitter feed today is just full of all sorts of comments and commentary related to the confirmation hearings of Judge Neil Gorsuch, who is President Trump's nominee for the vacant seat on the Supreme Court. My favorite line of the day was this one. Well, actually, every time Judge Gorsuch responds to one of the senators with "gee" or "gosh," I got to say, those are just times that make me smile. But this was a really good line. He says, "Look, I don't wear a crown. I wear a robe." And pretty much at every opportunity that he has had to remind the senators that there is equal justice under the law and that every person is equal before the court, that has been a line of repetition throughout the day. He said, in relationship to the question asked about whether or not Trump just picked him because Trump wants somebody to get in there and overturn Roe v. Wade, Gorsuch said he would have walked out the door if Trump had asked him to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, why? What kind of conversation does that provoke? Well, that provokes a conversation about precedents and his respect for the precedents set by the court. And you don't just flip rulings because you disagree with them. There has to be some actual legitimate process that you would undertake. And you don't prejudge any kind of case. And so that has been a theme throughout today's Q&A as well. Now, this Q&A that's going on today is expected to last a full 10 hours. And I would say that the next couple of days are likely to be just as interesting and just as hot. So we're going to actually have a conversation, extended conversation, in the second half of the program today. And I'm going to interview John Malcolm from the Heritage Foundation, who knows a whole lot more about the Supreme Court and a whole lot more about Neil Gorsuch than I do. And so we look forward to that in the second half. So let's jump today to the other big thing that happened yesterday on Capitol Hill, and that was the testimony of FBI Director James Comey, who never used the L word, but it's really hard to get to the place where you couldn't say that he's basically accusing the president of lying. Now, the FBI director serves at the leisure of the president, or at the pleasure of the president, and so he's not going to come right out and say, look, the dude lied. He's not going to say that. However, lines like this, I have no information that supports that claim. When the FBI director has to say that about himself, about the information that the FBI has been able to gather in relationship to specifically President Trump repeatedly accusing former President Barack Obama of wiretapping his phone in Trump Tower, the FBI director explained that not only he and the FBI, but also the Department of Justice and all of its entities, quote, have no information that support this claim. So what I want to spend a couple of minutes about, here talking with you about is our relationship with the truth. So what's your relationship with the truth? Because ultimately, for us as Christians, that's where the rubber meets the road in this particular conversation. And frankly, that's where the rubber meets the road when we start talking about the Bible and we start talking about the application of God's revealed will to our lives. And so this isn't just some conversation that is happening on the cultural level. This is a conversation that, you know, happens between you and the Lord, frankly, in every moment of every day. The relationship with the truth conversation, and whether or not I'm not only a truthful person who is full of truth, but a person who recognizes truth from falsehood, a person who speaks truth in love, but who speaks truth, a person who never gives way to the temptation to follow the father of lies and to be deceitful and to be duplicitous and to be hypocritical, certainly not to be a person who is filled with guile. All right? So there's actually like a spectrum of ideas here when we talk about your relationship to the truth. So on one end of what I call the truth spectrum, you could draw this out in your mind. So way over here on the right side of the truth spectrum, because that won't surprise you, that over here on the right side is where I think the truth spectrum is a good end of the scale. So let's do that. So over here on the right side of the truth spectrum, you can visualize this in your mind. We've got the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And yes, I would go ahead and add, so help me God. Because you and I both know that without God helping us, we're not going to be people of the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We got to have God's help to be that. Like, we recognize that. We're prone to sin. And lying, particularly lying that helps us or helps advance something we're interested in, I got to tell you, there's a huge temptation to that all the time. To maybe, well, only tell the facts that benefit us, or only tell the part of the story that benefits us, or only tell the part that makes us look good or makes our side look good. Okay, that might be the truth, but it's not the whole truth. And then there's sort of the temptation to exaggeration. I got to tell you, the temptation to exaggeration is huge, especially for those of us who like to tell stories. Okay, stories can be made a whole lot more interesting if, well, you just embellish them a little bit. Okay, but here's the deal. Christians, we are people who are bearing witness in every moment of every day, in every environment that we're in, to a guy who's actually not just the way and the life, he's the truth. He's the way and the truth and the life. And we're not just using Jesus as an access point to get back to the Father, right? This is not using Jesus, the way and the truth and the life, just because, well, frankly, he's the only way to get back to the goodies of heaven. No, that is not what a restored relationship with God the Father through Jesus Christ the Son by the power of the Holy Spirit, that's not what it's about. The gospel is a whole lot bigger than that. It's about the redemption of who you are, the restoration of who God made you to be. And part of that is becoming a person of truth, whose relationship with the truth is way over here on the right end of the truth spectrum. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Yes, so help me God. All right, so let's march away from that point on the spectrum. And somewhere in here, most of us are going to find ourselves. So as I move away from the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, you know, there's a migration toward like half-truth. And somewhere between the whole truth and the half of the truth or half truths is like, oh, well, I just misspoke, or I just mischaracterized something, or I misrepresented something, or I left something out that I knew but I chose not to include for one reason or another. In here is the whole world of white lies. Well, I didn't really want to say all that because it's going to hurt someone's feelings. Well, I got to tell you, it might hurt your feelings to hear that without Jesus, you're not going to heaven. But how much do I have to hate you to not tell you that part of the truth? Okay, so speak the truth, speak it in love, speak all of it, all of it. Speak the wholeness of the truth. All right, so now we find our way down here to half-truths. On the other side of half-truths, man, we're just total falsehood. Once you get half-truth where, you know, most of what you're saying is actually dominated by stuff that's not true. So now we got dishonesty, we got falsehood, we got deceit, we've got active deception. This is where people are being duplicitous, double-minded, fork-tongued, hypocrites. Some of these words should sound familiar to you. And then way down on the far end, as far from the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help us God. Way down here on the other end of the truth spectrum, you've got guile. Now, guile is the kind of thing that works itself into the human heart and mind and manifests itself in something like, well, not just getting after your neighbor Bathsheba in ways that you shouldn't while her husband's out of town at war on your behalf, but setting that guy up, His name was Uriah the Hittite, by the way. This is a reference to a story about King David in the Old Testament. A guy, by the way, who was known to be a man after God's own heart. So this can happen to us. This can happen to people who are, for a period of time, walking with God. But David, he didn't just lie about his relationship with Bathsheba. He set her husband up. And ultimately, he set it up so that Uriah would be killed. Okay, that's guile. You go on that far. This is not just half-truths and deception. This is pure guile. Well, what happens down there at that end? Well, down there at that end, man, we need a prophet. We need somebody speaking into our lives who can walk us through our issues in the same way that Nathan walked David through his issues. So here's my prayer today. My prayer today is that God would lift up a Nathan in the life of Donald Trump. So I'm just going to ask you to pray with me today that God would do that, that God would lift up a prophet like Nathan in the life of Donald Trump. Now, I'm not saying that President Trump is full of guile, but his relationship with the truth is certainly not very robust. His relationship with the truth leaves something to be desired. And for those who want to be an advocate of Donald Trump, we would be a whole lot better off if we were able to support with facts the statements that he makes. And so let's all just hope that we're moving in that direction. Here's the other deal. The American people are very forgiving. And so if at this point the time has come when it's time for the president to say, okay, look, I misspoke. I didn't really think that wiretapping was like a thing, a formal thing, and that when I used the term wiretapping, it meant something like super duper specific. I was just using wiretapping as like slang, and I didn't really mean Barack Obama. I really just meant that, you know, that crowd of folks that don't like me and didn't want me to be elected, you know, that crowd of folks, well, they were snooping around conversations that, well, not really me and in Trump Tower, but people who love me, right? Okay, that is a whole different conversation than what was actually said. And so we have to be careful with our words. We've talked about that. Words have meaning. Words have power. When they're spoken or tweeted by certain people, they even have more power. But if the president were simply to come clean and say, okay, look, I misspoke, I shouldn't have said it, please forgive me. The American people are very forgiving. Consider the things we have forgiven of former presidents that were far more serious than 140 characters on Twitter. So if you misspoke, say you misspoke. If you told a flat out lie, then admit it. The American people are very forgiving. They're also increasingly skeptical of those who are inauthentic. And authenticity requires honesty, sometimes brutal honesty about ourselves. So the questions before us are many. How do we know the difference between truth and falsehood? Once we've established the difference between truth and falsehood, how do we appropriately call out error? When presented with the truth or the facts of a matter, how do we accept them? And how do we acknowledge acceptance of them, even if up to this point we have been vociferously defending the truth that we now found out is not true? Are we people of truth, or are we people of a particular position, regardless of what we discover the truth to be? That is going to be the question that a lot of folks are going to need to answer in the coming days. So in the lead up to the events of Holy Week, which is the final week of Jesus' life. We think of it as the week between Palm Sunday and Easter, the week that culminates in Jesus' atoning sacrifice on the cross. In the lead up to Holy Week, truth matters. Truth should always matter to Christians. But in this particular season, I'm going to just really encourage us to look ourselves in the mirror and have a conversation about our relationship with the truth. And then you got to have that same conversation with the one who is truth, the God of truth, the God who is truth. Truth and goodness and beauty are the three transcendental virtues. Like you can't really be godly and be a liar. You can't be a child of God operating out of a relationship with the truth that is deceptive. All right. So, Christians who defend lies and Christians who defend liars in any area of life cannot be then trusted to tell the truth about Jesus. And so, this is going to come down to a conversation about where our real allegiance lies. I am most concerned in this life. I am most concerned. My highest priority concern is to represent Jesus well to other people. I am first a Christian. I am first a follower of Jesus Christ. I am first a person who is an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven. I am secondarily many other things. But if my relationship with the one who is the truth is complicated by my defense of lies or liars, then I have really compromised my witness. I've compromised my ability to talk with people about who Jesus is as the way and the truth and the life if I cannot be trusted on other matters of truthfulness. So these conversations in the culture are ultimately conversations about something much greater, the question of how each one of us handles the truth. All right, folks, there's a lot of other big things happening right now, even on Capitol Hill. There's big things happening on Wall Street. There's big things happening on Main Street. And each and every one of those things has an impact, you know, on, you know, well, this would be kind of funny to you. I live on a road called Street. So, you know, on Capitol Hill and Wall Street and Main Street, it all has an impact on Street Road, right? So whatever the name of your road is that you live on, all of the things that happen on Capitol Hill and Wall Street and Main Street have an impact on your road you live on, your little patch of earth. So healthcare reform is underway. I'm sure you have been hearing about it. I'm sure that some of you have been wringing your hands about it. Here's the reality. I don't know exactly what they're going to come up with, but it's not going to be exactly what it looks like now. The same thing is true for the Trump budget. Okay? The first draft of any budget is not ultimately the budget. I mean, everybody's all freaked out that, you know, Amtrak, if the budget that was presented actually gets through, that, you know, Amtrak's going to have to reduce or eliminate services in like 23 states. Well, the head of Amtrak is like, whoa, 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 people, hey, the first budget is not the budget. Don't be all freaking out. Okay, so give them some time, let them work through the process, speak your piece to your representatives, certainly let yourself be heard wherever you're at on the spectrum of concern related to healthcare reform. But Thursday's vote, which is scheduled for a vote on Thursday, it certainly could be delayed, but it's currently set for a vote in Congress on Thursday. And it's going to have a real impact on real people and the reality of how we allocate our household income. And so we're going to pay attention to that. And we'll come back to that once we know more about the details of what the plan is really going to be. But something else happened, and this happened actually almost a week ago now, but I haven't heard anybody talking about it. And in another time of news cycles, everybody would have been talking about a raise in rates by the Fed. You're saying to yourself, okay, I'm not even really quite clear what the Fed is. Okay, neither am I. But they raised the interest rate 6 days ago, and they might do so again a couple more times before the end of 2017. And so because all economics are home economics, right? My mom was a home economist, so she trained me very early on that everything is about home economics. Don't let anybody fool you. Those economists up there with those big fancy degrees, it all comes down to whether or not it works its way out around the kitchen table. Right? Because that's where the beans are actually counted. The bean counters? Where are the real bean counters? Who's actually counting beans? The women at home counting beans, shelling peas. I'm telling you, the real home economist and the real home economics is happening at the home. And women are actually the driving force when it comes to the economy of the home. So I want to move to, with that in mind, a conversation about Ivanka Trump. Ivanka Trump is the daughter of President Trump. She is married to a guy named Jared Kushner, and there's a lot of brouhaha in Washington about the fact that, well, she is going to have an office in the West Wing. She's going to move into an office in the White House. Okay, well, who does that surprise? Like, I don't think that surprises anybody. She's one of her dad's closest advisors. And I got to tell you, as a woman in the working world, and as a woman who's got, you know, kids and got trying to figure out all kinds of stuff during spring break about who's going to take care of who, and we got, you know, all of the things that are related to managing a family and managing a career, I like Ivanka Trump. I like that she's concerned about women in the workforce. I like that she's concerned about kids. And it doesn't bother me at all that she has the ear of the president. I think we got a better chance of things that are of mutual concern to us as Christians and as women finding their way into some of the policy decisions of the day. So this is a little shout out to folks at CNN, the article that you have posted on Ivanka Trump getting top security clearance and an office in the White House has a sentence that reads, "Trump's husband, Jared Kushner," which I just want to say, I think is kind of a funny read. And I think that maybe when the last name of the person that you're referring to is also the name of the president, you should also use their first name. So that's just an encouragement. Okay. So just because her name already appeared once in the article, you can't just refer to her, first of all, by her maiden name. But anyway, you get the point. All right, I digress. Advisor Kellyanne Conway faces these same kinds of concerns as a working mom in the White House. And so I raise this because you're going to be hearing a lot more about this. And frankly, this is an issue where the church has lagged behind in the conversation and the culture, and we got some catching up to do. My kids have teachers who are working moms. My kids' doctor is a working mom. My kids' friends' moms are working moms. My sister is a working mom. My mom was a working mom. I'm a working stepmom. If we read the Bible, there are lots of working moms, people balancing the demands of home and children and husbands. Husbands who, by the way, were often away somewhere else doing what God had called them to do. So if you'd like a little encouragement and a little resource on the subject of this conversation that's happening in the culture and in the government, we've got a resource posted for you by Courtney Reisig. It's on our website, reconnectwithcarmen.com. It's entitled "Thinking Like a Christian Regarding Paid Family Leave." We actually posted it on the 10th of March, but if you can go and grab that, it's a guest post on our website by Courtney Reisig, and it's entitled "Thinking Like a Christian Regarding Paid Family Leave." Christians have been lagging behind in this conversation. As I said, we've been lagging behind for quite a while. And I think that I'll just close by saying this on this particular subject. We're going to have to get over the guilt related to work or related to moms in the workforce. Because the reality of most of the economies of our homes now, in order for our kids to go to private Christian school or in order for our kids to, we're still hoping, you know, have a better life than the one we have. It actually requires at this stage of the game that both parents be working. And there are some folks who have figured out in their own home economics how to only have one person working. But in an increasing number of cases in our culture, that one person who's working is the woman. And so I don't know how we get to the place where we destigmatize this in the life of the church, but I'm going to encourage us to have that conversation. This is not about spiritual headship. This is about economics. This is about being, you know, the dyer of purple cloth. This is about being the Proverbs 31 woman. Hey, all of you out there who think the Proverbs 31 woman is the woman, she's a working mom. So I just want to, you know, I just want to lift up to you the reality that maybe the image of the way that our grandparents did it is different, and it's not necessarily better or worse. And we need to look at the opportunities that are now afforded to everybody in our family in terms of doing the economics of our own home as we move forward. So I do want to ensure a biblical perspective on all of these things, because I do think that it's easy to simply take a feminist perspective, because that's the cultural water that we've been swimming in, and that is not what I'm advocating. So please don't hear me say that. Please don't hear me say that I'm advocating a feminist agenda on this particular subject. But I would like for us to have a biblical perspective on these things. And I'm not sure that our cultural perspective at this point is very biblical. So again, we got a resource posted for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. It's a guest post by Courtney Reisig, "Thinking Like a Christian Regarding Paid Family Leave." All right, friends, the Reconnect is a listener-supported program by people just like you. We'd appreciate it if you took a minute to visit us at reconnectwithcarmen.com and donate to the ministry if you're in a position to do so. Hey, when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking with John Malcolm from the Heritage Foundation about the ongoing confirmation hearings in front of the Senate of Judge Neil Gorsuch. This is The Reconnect. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. I don't know if it was as loud for you coming back from the break as it was for me, but we're back, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we are talking about what people are talking about, and we're also talking with the people who are helping us talk about those things in a way that honors Jesus. So today we are talking about the Senate confirmation hearing of Judge Neil Gorsuch, and we are talking about that with John Malcolm. He oversees the Heritage Foundation work to increase understanding of the Constitution and the rule of law. He directs their think tank, the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. That's a bit of a tongue twister. Sorry about that. He's also the former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Justice Criminal Division. And so he understands what we're talking about when we're talking about the rule of law in America and when we're talking about the Supreme Court. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He also holds a bachelor's degree in economics from Columbia College. You can follow him on Twitter at @Malcolm_John. Welcome to The Reconnect.
That was a very thorough introduction. I'm impressed. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. Okay, so we want to be people in the culture who have ears that hear and eyes that see and minds that understand and comprehend what's going on. And sometimes that means we need people to help us hear better what we're listening to. And so I'm hoping today that during our conversation, you can help us hear some things that we may not be hearing as lay people when we're watching or listening to or even listening to coverage of the confirmation hearings of Judge Gorsuch. So let me just start here if I can. The word precedence and then the introduction of the word super precedence. Can you help us with that?
Sure. Well, a precedent is just a ruling by a higher court that is supposed to be followed by lower courts. So if the Supreme Court issues a ruling on either a statutory question or a constitutional question, lower federal court judges, and for that matter state court judges, are bound to follow it. Now, the Supreme Court is at liberty, with respect to a statutory question, if the Supreme Court said this is what a statute means, Congress can always pass a new statute that says you were wrong. And on constitutional questions, the Supreme Court can always reconsider its past precedent and overrule its past precedent or overturn it. What you're hearing now at the Senate confirmation hearings is a bit of a kabuki dance, which is that, you know, everyone's going to talk about the importance of the of judges remaining independent, while at the same time they're going to try to tie Judge Gorsuch down to supporting precedents that they like and pledging to reconsider precedents that they don't like. So a precedent is a precedent. What you're hearing people use phrases like super-duper precedent is it's a precedent that the Supreme Court has reaffirmed on a number of occasions, or in some cases where there are a lot of reliance interests. So people change their lives. They make business decisions. They make personal decisions. They make financial decisions in reliance on that precedent. And if you were to overturn that precedent, not that they can't, there'd just be a recognition that it would be quite disruptive because of the number of people who have made fundamental decisions in their lives based on that precedent.
Okay, so let's use two examples here. Roe v. Wade is the example that was being used at the time when the conversation was happening. I think it was Senator Feinstein who was sort of drilling in on this point of super precedence. But it occurs to me when you give us that sort of second example of, hey, if it's something that people have really, you know, frankly, hinged their life to, certainly the Obergefell decision related to same-sex marriage, if I were in a court of law, I'd be arguing, hey, you can't reverse this because so many people have already made life-altering decisions based on it. Am I thinking
the right
way? Okay.
Yeah, no, you're thinking about it the right way. It's not that they can't reverse it. It's that they shouldn't reverse it because of the fact that now you have thousands, if not tens of thousands, of gay couples that have gotten married. The Supreme Court can certainly do that. So, you know, not with this Justice Gorsuch, because Justice Scalia was in the minority, but if you of the Obergefell decision, but if you were to replace one of the justices in the 5-4 majority and a state were to pass a law that said we're going to go back to the traditional approach to marriage and all other marriages are unlawful, they would go into the lower federal courts and say, look, you need to rule against me because there's this Obergefell precedent, but they can get up to the Supreme Court and say you should reconsider your precedent, and that they might do it or they might not do it. They could do it, but there would be a lot of people arguing that it would be a bad thing to do because of all these reliance interests. A little bit of a difficult question with respect to Roe versus Wade, because of course, you know, abortion is a future decision to make. There aren't people who are making decisions today, you know, based on the availability of abortion on demand. But certainly, if they were to overturn Roe versus Wade, that would change a lot of people's views about the court, and people would have to make different decisions, personal decisions, about their reproductive choices in the future.
Okay, so let's stick with Senator Feinstein for a minute. She said yesterday that I'm just going to read you part of what she said, that she finds Judge Gorsuch's originalist judicial philosophy to be really troubling. When she says that, what does she mean, and what is she interested in instead?
Well, she's interested in what has been referred to as living constitutionalism, which is to say that the Constitution as originally drafted may have been suitable for our forebears in the late 1700s, but in these modern times with modern sensibilities about what's right and fair and just, that Supreme Court justices should read into the Constitution new rights that our founding fathers would have found more than passing strange. So the right to same-sex marriage might be an example of that. A right to abortion might be an example of that, because same-sex marriage and abortion were outlawed in virtually every state and colony at the time our Constitution was drafted. But they think that that should not be an impediment. They shouldn't rely on leaving this up to the democratic process. They shouldn't rely on the amendment process to amend the Constitution to provide for new rights. That justices should be able to take the existing Constitution and read new rights into it. That the Constitution should evolve and not be stuck back based on its original public meaning at the time those provisions were ratified.
All right, friends. And so if you've been listening to me for a while, you know that I see a clear connection or parallel in terms of the way we read the scriptures and those different camps of individuals who interpret the scriptures, either as God's divine inspired word, not that the Constitution is on that level, but we have a way of reading the Bible that is consistent with and seeks to submit to the author's meaning versus a view of scriptural interpretation that says, hey, what's happening in the world today and what I'm experiencing, it needs to be brought to the text and is the interpretive key that I'm going to use in this ever-evolving or progressive understanding of scripture. So there's a parallel there for those of us who study the scriptures and those who are students of the Constitution. All right, we're talking today with John Malcolm. He oversees the Heritage Foundation's work to increase understanding of the Constitution and the rule of law. And so you can follow him on Twitter at Malcolm_John. And there's tons of resources at the Heritage Foundation website if you guys are really interested in these things. All right, John, what have you heard thus far from Judge Gorsuch that inspires you as a legal professional?
Well, look, he's a very polished individual who has thought deeply about the Constitution, the proper role of a judge to make decisions based on the rule of law, whether he agrees with the outcome or not. It's not his job to amend laws that Congress passes and recognizes that occasionally Congress will pass a bad law that will end up with an outcome that he doesn't particularly like as an individual, but he is applying equal justice under law and says he's not going to be a legislator in robe. I happen to believe in an originalist approach to judging. He's made it quite clear not only in his testimony but through countless numbers of opinions that he's issued over the last 10 years as a judge that he is an originalist. He does try as best as possible read constitutional cases in the light of the original public meaning that those provisions meant at the time that they were ratified, and that he will also look within the four corners of a statute and not try to divine some hidden congressional intent based on something that a senator might have inserted in the middle of the night into the congressional record. He clearly has adhered to this approach in case after case after case, including reaching results that he has made clear he did not like as an individual, but he thought was the right thing to do. And I think that's what a good judge should do.
Well, I think we thought going into this that we were going to hear a lot of argument, you know, that, oh, he's not a part of the mainstream. He's not a part of the mainstream. And man, he absolutely pulled that rug out from under anybody yesterday when he's like, oh, so my clerks tell me 99% of the time I'm with the majority. So you'd have to be arguing that the majority is not the mainstream. So he, again, your note that he is, that he's polished and thoughtful. I'll just tell you that three of the things that I've heard from him so far that make me smile are the words gee, golly, and gosh. Because I wasn't expecting those, right? Like, I was, you know, I wasn't expecting, like, he's like, gee, well, I love that. I just, he's so human, and I think that's a really nice surprise.
Yeah,
all right, so let's
go ahead.
Well, let's go from, you know, things that we are excited about to things that maybe worry us a little bit. Is there anything thus far that worries you in terms of issues or the judge's ability to answer specific questions?
No, look, I don't think so. I will put a lot of faith in a thoughtful judge who believes that our primary liberties come from adhering strictly to the separation of powers that's in the Constitution. I'll put my faith in a judge who's an originalist and a textualist who clearly struggles hard to apply those consistently. You know, so he hasn't ruled on a lot of issues that, that conservatives and, for that matter, liberals might care about, like gun control or abortion or gay rights or things like that. But, you know, it's his approach to judging and the seriousness and rigor with which he approaches that task that give me a lot of faith that he's going to be a superb justice on the court. It's not that I'm going to agree with every decision that he comes out with, but, you know, it's somebody whose views on any subject I will respect.
So is there any one exchange thus far in the conversations, in the confirmation hearing, is there any one exchange that stands out in your mind as, wow, that looked like it could have gone one way, I'm really impressed with the way he dealt with that, something that stands out in your mind at this point?
Well, I think he is, you know, he's batted down everything that's come his way. I mean, his opening statement yesterday, which I would urge people to read or get on YouTube, was brilliant when he says that when a judge puts on a robe that he should lose his ego and open his mind. And he talked about the headstone of a jurist that he found, an 18th century judge, when he was up in Boston one day, who talked about all of the great virtues of this person as an individual and as a judge. And he said, you know, I keep that on my desk, and if somebody could say that about me when I drop off this mortal coil, that would be a good thing. Certainly he's addressed issues about whether he favors corporations or favors this person or that person. He's addressed questions about, you know, applying the law faithfully in cases in which he didn't like the outcome, but he felt that the rule of law required him to reach this result. He certainly batted down this ridiculous allegation that was made by one of his former students that he was somehow against women lawyers or saying inappropriate things about the plight of women lawyers who go in for job interviews and are asked about their family plans. He put that all into perspective. I think he's doing a very effective job of defending himself, not that he really has to defend himself because his record is spotless.
All right, and so we've only got a couple of days of this left, which this is a long time for a person to sit and sort of be kind of interrogated. I'm with you. I think he's doing a marvelous job. I like your image of batting things down. And the April 19th gotcha question, he dealt with superbly. So I agree with you on that as well. Is there one thing you're hoping that he gets asked? If you had the opportunity to ask him a question, what would your question be, and why would that be the question you would want people to hear the answer to?
Well, I'm not sure he hasn't been asked it, and I'm not sure what if you adhere to the kinds of answers that he'd given, whether I would get that answer. I mean, so I would ask him about his adherence to precedent and sort of his approach about when you think those settled expectations are such that you're going to let a precedent stand, even if you think that something was wrongly decided as an initial matter of constitutional jurisprudence. He's been asked that in some ways, and you know, he's giving an appropriate answer to say, look, I can't tell you that without having the briefings in any particular case. I mean, look, anything you want to know about Judge Gorsuch, you can read in his opinions in very, very thoughtful speeches to get a sense as to what kind of a man this is. And he's clearly humble and thoughtful and highly regarded, and obviously for very good reason.
Absolutely. Well, John Malcolm, thank you so much for being our educator today and helping us listen hopefully more effectively to the conversations that we're overhearing in these Senate confirmation hearings of Judge Neil Gorsuch. We look forward to future conversations with you and appreciate the work of the Heritage Foundation.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. All right, friends, this is the point in the show where we like to go below the fold and lift up stories and help you make connections, well, that at first don't appear to be about God, but hopefully are going to help you engage in conversations with other people about something that's going on out there in the world that gives you an opportunity to kind of set a hook in the conversation where, you know, you have the opportunity to say, hey, there's a principle here that we ought to be talking about. This isn't, you know, maybe this seems like a laughing matter on the surface, but hey, what's below the surface of this? And so I have a above the surface, below the surface story for you today, which now that I've told you that, you're not going to find very funny. The selfie-crazed teens, two teenage boys, keep falling through the frozen Central Park pond. All right, so we got two teenage boys who, in an attempt to take a selfie of themselves, obviously, fell through the ice in the pond in Central Park. And here's the big part of the story. This is not the first time this has happened. In fact, this apparently happens on a fairly regular basis. People walk out onto the ice on the Central Park pond and attempt to take selfies and in so doing fall into the frigid water. I gotta tell you, people, don't get on a frozen pond in the last week of March. There's a reason we call it the first day of spring, all right? I don't really care where you are. This is not safe activity. All right, so here's the story. Another group of kids attempting to take a selfie on top of some ice at the pond in Central Park, plunged into the icy waters. Now, these two teenage boys, ages 15 and 13, were able to swim ashore and walked away from the scene, but the cops caught up with them. They caught up with them at the park's 60th Street exit near 6th Avenue, for those of you who know this part of New York City. The teenagers had no visible signs of injuries, but the cops took them to St. Luke's Hospital for observation nonetheless. So I got to tell you, like, you were going to be in trouble when you got home and your clothes were soaking wet. But now somebody's got to come to the hospital. And because you're minors, they got to go through the whole process of, like, reclaiming you from the cops. Like, this got a whole lot worse for these kids who were really just trying to do something silly and take a picture of themselves. But last month, a group of seven teenage boys had the same experience, fell through the ice in the same pond, attempting to take a group selfie in Central Park on the pond. So here's what I want to say about this. And you have heard me say this before. Our selfie culture is so self-centered, so focused on the self, so focused on self-promotion and self-identity and self-glorification. None of that could be more contrary to the Christian worldview. From a Christian perspective, from the Christian worldview, the self actually yields always and in all ways to the identity of Jesus Christ. It is literally, as Paul says, no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Now, the very word identity is a loaded word today. We think about identity politics. We think about people who are declaring a particular identity, or they're struggling to understand their identity. And wrapped up in all those layers of politics and isms and causes is the reality of people who are having a hard time finding themselves because they don't know from whence they have come. They don't know who they are because they don't know what they are. They don't know that they're human beings, and they don't know what that means. And so the identity crisis that people are experiencing in our culture today is very real, and it's quite serious. And it actually, it's manifest in our institutions as well. It's manifest in who we are as a nation. I mean, every time you hear competing ideals advocated as American values, every time you hear the budget, the forthcoming budget debate, or even the debate over healthcare, and when you hear someone say, as America or as Americans, that's not who we are, okay? That's an identity conversation. When you hear someone declare that as Americans, we are our brother's keeper, okay, well, first of all, your job as a student of the Bible is to do what? Well, you got to set the biblical hook into that illusion right away, and you got to say, "I am so glad you brought up Scripture. I didn't really know that Scripture was the prevailing authority in your life because, you know, you pretty much function as a secular atheist. I'm thinking in terms here of my friend who actually wrote a compelling article recently about America and the concept of Brother's Keeper. And he certainly is a very out secular humanist. And so, you know, I'd have to say, hey, thanks for setting the biblical hook. Didn't know we were appealing to Scripture for authority here. Thank you for lifting up the conversation about my brother's keeper. Let's talk about the whole story from whence that comes. Let's talk about Cain and Abel. Let's talk about the context of that part of Genesis. Let's talk about what comes just prior to that. And then let's talk about what comes in the beginning of the book. When God actually designed all of this, when God made it, he created it to be good. He created it as good, and he created it for good. We're the ones who marred that, messed that up. It's called sin. And why? Well, because we became focused on ourselves. We, instead of finding our identity as the children of God, we tried to find our identity in ourselves. We wanted to be like God. We wanted to have the knowledge of good and evil. I got to tell you, at that point in time, Adam and Eve only had a knowledge of good. And instead, they thought it preferable to have a knowledge of good and evil? Are you kidding me? Wouldn't you love to have the opportunity to only have a knowledge of good? That was it. That's what they traded. They traded the knowledge of good, the knowledge of God himself, and a fully orbed relationship with him as people who were created in his image. And they traded the knowledge of good for the knowledge of good and evil. That's the exchange that happens in sin. And I don't know about you, I would much prefer to live in a world where all we knew was good. But the reason that we know evil is our own sinfulness. The reason that we have a knowledge of evil is because we preferred our own way of thinking and our own way of doing it and our own way to what God had outlined as his preferred way, as the way that he knew would be best for us. But we are in a full-blown identity crisis in this country. And it goes right down to conversations about individuals. Way up here, in the conversation that's happening in the culture, we have a conversation about the identity of America as a country, who we are, what we believe, what are our values, what are we, you know, are we actually in the world to do something or to be something or to promote something or to advance something? Or are we just one nation among many and we too will pass into the night just like every other nation does? And, you know, well, that'll be it. Our time has come. Our time will go. There's an identity crisis going on in America right now. And it's happening at the level of our institutions, and it's happening all the way down at the level of individuals. Time Magazine and National Geographic, both this year, have already had cover articles featuring people transitioning from a biological gender of male and female to a semblance of the other gender through a combination of what I will describe as powerful drugs, therapy, and surgery, deforming their otherwise healthy bodies into something that they were not. Beauty and the Beast, the action movie, doesn't just have a gay scene. It has a whole gay storyline running through it. The Power Ranger movie coming out this Friday, we'll talk about more about this later in the week, but the yellow Power Ranger, spoiler alert, is having a sexual identity crisis in this film. We don't know who we are because we don't know what we are. Human beings made in the image of God. We don't know what we are because we don't know whose we are. His name is God. He is the creator and the father of us all. He is goodness and beauty and truth and love and grace and holiness. He sent his son, Jesus, born of the Virgin Mary, to live among us, full of grace and truth, to die for us, an atoning sacrifice upon the cross, in order that what? In order that we could know God, even as we are fully known. That's the promise of a redeemed life. That's the promise of being people of truth. So I'm going to call you to that today. I'm going to call you to be a person of truth out there in a world of confusion and lies. Be a person who knows who you are and whose you are and what you're here to do. Proclaim the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ for all humanity. Hey, this is The Reconnect. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. And I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.